Welcome, friends of the Libra Solutions Network. My name is Gabriel, and I am the creator and founder of the Libra Solutions Network, where I try to really add some detail to the finer points of technological discussions when it comes to tyranny and what we can do to really counteract top-down information control, censorship, and many of the other issues we are concerned about in our time here. And so I am very pleased to have Michael Ginsberg join me here today to talk about trouble in tech, which I am basically going to file down as all the different problems we see right now as far as what's hurting people, what's being sending people down, you know, the wrong direction, so to speak. And so, Michael, just how would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Gabriel. So, I'm Michael. I'm the founder of Actionable Truth Media, where I take a little bit of a different angle to independent media. So, the hint is kind of in the name. I think there's a lot of obviously independent media out there now that does great work. But I think some of them or a lot of them have kind of gotten into the space of it's kind of fear porn or doom scrolling in the sense that, like, you know, okay, well, they tell you things about what's happening, what's really happening in our world, which are very, very important things. But then they kind of leave you hanging there in the sense, okay, well, what do I do with this information? What do we do about it? How do we stop it? And that's something that I think is a little bit missing in the space. And that's kind of where, that's the reason why I decided to, start Actionable Truth. My background, I guess, from a previous life. So I come from a technology background as well, technology and digital marketing. I worked in tech for a fair bit of time in various roles, doing various things, including cybersecurity and things like that, privacy, auditing, technology consulting. So obviously quite familiar with this space. And obviously this is a topic that is of great interest to me, Gabriel. So happy to talk about it.
Yeah, and my perspective on a lot of this is that we are actually in pretty bad shape. We have had big tech, you know, for the last 10 years openly manipulate not just, you know, the users, but also the public discussion at large. And governments are trying to basically win that tug of war over power over the public rather than necessarily properly decentralize it. The challenge is that just because somebody comes in saying they have a solution, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a perfect one, which is why I think you are a great person to have a conversation about these kinds of non-solutions to many of these issues. And so first up, the most obvious non-solution that will come to mind for technology is effectively what I call the X operation or Elon Musk's X. On the screen here, I have a tweet from CJ Hopkins where he points out that during 2020 and 2022, you know, between that range during the COVID crisis, there was a pretty, you know, broad and diverse group of people from so many different walks of life who were really interested in tackling censorship, in tackling top-down information control, and doing what they can to actually, you know, liberate themselves from these systems. But it seems as though since he purchased X and many people are like, oh, he saved free speech. He saved us. He is the savior that will save all of us from whether it's the deep state, which, yeah, it's a real problem. There are real problems with government exerting influence over corporations, but I'm not comfortable with private information control either. So what are your thoughts on the Musk operation as a whole?
Well, we can talk about that for an hour easily, no problem at all. Look, it's an interesting one, right? When Musk first bought Twitter, and there's like that famous, like I think the day that he purchased Twitter, he posted this video of him walking with a sink into Twitter HQ and, like, you know, let that sink in or something along those lines. And everyone thought, oh, this guy is so cool. This guy's going to like smash everyone and it's going to be amazing, right? I guess go like a step back. I mean, obviously before Musk bought Twitter, it wasn't any better. I mean, obviously we know with things like, thanks to things like the Twitter files, that, like, you know, the censorship there has been embedded, has been highly organized, and has been orchestrated directly by intelligence agencies. I mean, that is a fact. Now, as soon as Musk bought Twitter, one of the first things he did was obviously the Twitter files. And, you know, he got on board various independent journalists and they released important information. And that information was kind of like, you know, earth shattering because, like, for the first time, you had like definitive, undeniable proof of, like, you know, government being involved in censorship during the COVID era and even before that. And it was like a kind of like a big deal. And it gave Musk a lot of credibility as a freedom fighter and as a defender of free speech, right? But that's usually how a limited hangout works, right? You do have to release truthful information to get credibility, but then you also use that credibility that you've achieved in order to divert people from other things. And I think even a lot of the journalists that have been involved in with the Twitter files, like, you know, starting with Matt Taibbi, have openly admitted now that there were things that they were not allowed to see, and they don't even know what those things are, right? So that kind of starts being sus. Then you actually start looking, obviously, like, you know, Elon Musk has made very, like, you know, public statements all of a sudden that he's like a freedom fighter, that he's a conservative. But if you look at even his own tweets, just like, you know, prior to buying Twitter, like things about the vaccine and stuff like that, things that are quite troubling, to put it mildly. But when you start looking into his background, what he's actually involved in, I mean, come on. I mean, the guy literally wants to put a brain implant in your brain, to put a brain implant in your head. I mean, I mean, if that's not transhumanism, I don't know what is. I mean, honestly, like, people get, and I keep hearing it all the time. Like, people get sucked into what people are saying instead of actually looking at what they're actually doing. And more importantly, where their money is coming from. I mean, Musk is one of the biggest defense contractors in the U.S. Like, for NASA, he is the biggest. I think with NASA, he is the second biggest service provider after the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I mean,
wow!
Come on, guys. Right? So he's involved in transhumanism. He's involved in electric cars. He's creating humanoid robots. Like, you know, he's openly, like, you know, saying is AI is very dangerous, but he's developing his own, like, you know, Gen AI tool. I mean, come on, guys.
Yeah, I get really frustrated with the AI safety discussion because it feels like one of those many pincer moves where they can kind of go after the public at both ends. You've got, oh, we need AI safety research to regulate how we can keep general purpose computing or advanced computing out of people's hands. But at the same time, AI safety is kind of used as an excuse to kind of let big tech do whatever the hell they want in this space. You know, oh, who cares how they're using, you know, approaching copyright? Who cares about how these tools exist? And to me, why I find the concept so laughable is we haven't even reined in big tech from what they've done to us over the last 10 years, much less what they would do with AGI, which is the hypothetical scare tactic here. And to me, my biggest frustration with the Musk operation as a whole is you would think by now people would realize that a big tech corporation having total control and insight into everybody's conversations is effectively the ring of Sauron. It's too powerful. No group can be trusted with it. We can't trust, you know, the good guys to have the ability to censor and control what everybody's seeing and sharing. And that's a problem to me. And so you would hope that people would be more interested in decentralized solutions. Unfortunately, there have been some real letdowns that make it understandable why people would be so pessimistic, apathetic, or even just defeatist about decentralized solutions. And one of them was the way the Security and Exchange Commission down there in the USA went after Library. Library Inc. was running Odyssey, which was the video hosting platform that was in some ways decentralized because there was the Library blockchain. And how the Library blockchain worked was that you would basically have your own media server on your machine and you would provide access to either files you upload yourself or you would help share files from other people. And then that would allow you to earn the library currency, thus disintermediating, ideally, the process of sharing media online. The challenge here is that SEC went after Library specifically because of a decision they made with their tokens, because many blockchain and cryptocurrencies sometimes will have something called a pre-mine. And those pre-mines will be when they give themselves a large amount of tokens to fund development or do various different things. And one of the things they actually mentioned here in this post that I think is really worth looking at was there was a huge amount of library credits given to people to promote Odyssey. And this was something that, as I'm aware, wasn't really publicly disclosed at the time, and I don't know how much it was focused on in the lawsuit, but there were many issues around this time of how not just Library was used, but how tokens were used in general. And so this is kind of a long-winded introduction to what happened to Odyssey, at least up until now they're going into a new technological direction that we'll touch on later. But it is really worth pointing out that Library was not the worst offender in this category. You know, a lot of people will point out Sam Bankman-Fried and the whole FTX debacle. You know, just because something is using a blockchain does not mean it's decentralized at all. It does not mean there isn't a trap door that they can take all the assets from. And ironically, it seems like the Securities and Exchange Commission went after Odyssey, which is a platform that did actually do what it said it was doing, which is kind of tragic in a way. But I understand the discussion on securities, because if you are using cryptocurrency and you are part of the developing team and or just the funders of the project, and you hold on to those tokens going up in value does actually help your bottom line. And so, yes, I've gone in so many different directions there, Michael, but what to you stands out when it comes to Odyssey, at least up until the SEC really hammered down and basically destroyed Library Inc.?
Yeah, look, so I guess my first criteria, the most important criteria for anything decentralized is that it cannot be shut down. Whether they do illegal things or not is immaterial. I mean, illegal is a definition that is obviously determined by the government. So that's like the problem in itself, right? So if a government or any other authority or any other body or even a group of hackers can actually shut down the whole thing, by definition, it is not decentralized. Now, let's have a look at what happened with Odyssey, because it's an interesting one. I wasn't aware of, like, you know, that pre-minting and, like, you know, a lot of the founders got, like, you know, significant amount of tokens. It's pretty common with crypto projects.
It is.
So that by itself, yeah, that by itself is not a problem. But the fact that the SEC was even able to actually go after Library and shut down the blockchain, I believe, like, the blockchain is not running anymore. Is that correct?
That's not true. Actually, the Library blockchain itself is operational. What had to shut down was the Library Inc. company that was kind of managing everything. I did actually look at their Git repositories. The Library desktop client hasn't been updated in over a year, so I do think it's effectively destroyed the project, though yes, you can still install the client, you can still participate in the network, but as we're going to touch on later, they're kind of shifting what their whole network is running on in the first place.
Yeah.
Which I assume it'll, yeah.
Okay, that's an interesting one. Okay, so the blockchain itself is still running, but obviously the financial monetization incentive behind it has been removed. And as a result, it seems like there's not many resources diverted to that. That's fine. That's, again, pretty common. But the blockchain is running, so that's still good. I mean, in my perspective, that's a good sign. But what is interesting, and I don't know, maybe you know about it, but I tried to find information, and it was very hard to find. In that interim period when the SEC shut down Library Inc., right, and then Odyssey announced kind of like their new direction, the webs, like the service itself, like the app, was running in the interim without interruptions to the best of my ability, to the best of my knowledge, right? So how were they running? Like how were they sustaining themselves?
Well, that's an interesting question that I don't know if we have from them specifically, as far as why Odyssey.com, the, you know, system they're running, hasn't been impacted by that decision. And now they're using it to transition to a new blockchain on Arweave, which we'll touch on in a moment. But the thing is I believe the reason they were able to stay online is because Odyssey was separate from the Library blockchain in some ways. For instance, what you were doing when you were going to Odyssey.com is you were basically using a client that connected to, say, one of their nodes of the Library blockchain, and it made things work seamlessly. And this is the thing that I find interesting about various Web3 projects across the board, is that if you're being given tokens or the tokens are being abstracted from you, so for instance, you can use the Web3 project without, say, actually connecting a wallet, and it's built into the service, there's a challenge there where basically that service has control over how you're using it. It's called not your keys, not your coins, or whatever the particular token is. And so there is a challenge in the sense that Odyssey was, at least to my knowledge, separate enough that Library Inc. shutting down wasn't necessarily shutting down the same entity that probably ran Odyssey.com, though, for all I know, maybe they just simply maintain control and they weren't ordered to hand over domains or other things. Because I believe what happened is they, you know, lost their appeal to go out to against the SEC decision and basically were able to move in this new direction, as long as I guess they don't use the tokens. I'm guessing they're not allowed to use their library tokens anymore, as far as I know. Maybe that's a complicated legal question, and I'm certainly not a legal expert, especially in this area. I think there's a good reason to argue nobody is, considering, you know, there was this decision against Ripple in the same vein, which I think Ripple is less defensible than Odyssey and Library were by a wide margin. And Ripple was actually able to get their SEC judgment brought down by a substantial amount. And so I think the whole reason why Odyssey has been able to be maintained is, I think, because it was basically a front end for the library system, it was distinct enough that they were able to keep it online. And as I've kind of shown and you alluded to, they are now going in an entirely new direction where they are building on the Arweave blockchain. For those who aren't aware, I had to look into this myself because I actually hadn't heard of Arweave until you and I started chatting about an Odyssey, speculating on whether they would use that or Cardano. I will still go stick to my guns when I told you that I think Arweave probably is a better BIC than Cardano. Cardano has a lot of sketchy attachments that I would be very concerned about. And so what Arweave is it's a blockchain designed to basically be a Filecoin. You know, you use the token to secure access to storing files on the Arweave blockchain, in theory forever. They basically have a very complicated mathematical formula that they believe if you pay X amount, you'll be able to store Y amount of data, in theory forever, because storage gets cheaper over time. Interesting assumption. Hopefully it works out. I can't, you know, say for or against that either way. But as far as I could tell, Arweave mining itself was not very easy to get into. If you actually open the mining documentation, it would tell you that you're still responsible for your liabilities when it comes to GDPR, so data protection, which to me is an interesting sign of the fact that maybe they're not encrypting data as much as they should, or at least at that time when the documentation was written. There are some kind of red flags. And so to me, while I like the idea that Odyssey is trying to build a new decentralized media enterprise, I do have some concerns. And some of these concerns are, the first red flag is they're not just starting the token from zero. They're having this minting process that currently isn't open to Americans. And we can only speculate, but I'm assuming the reason why the process isn't open to Americans is because of the SEC judgment. You know, you can't issue tokens again if that's what you just got banhammered for. But then does that mean Americans are uniquely disadvantaged in using the system? This is complicated because this is not for Arweave itself. It's for Arweave AO. There's actually a difference between Arweave and Arweave AO, which is basically built on top of it. And that's something I kind of want to explain, is because Arweave itself is the Filecoin. It's just for data storage. It just exists to store files on this network, but they are building another system on top called Arweave AO, for actor oriented or something like that. And the goal is to basically build smart contracts or a decentralized computing platform on top of it. AO is what the minting is associated with. And I'm wondering at this stage of the game, if Odyssey is going to be using, Arweave just the basic storage token, in which case that's a pretty good idea, or if they're going to be using AO, which I would have some reservations about. And so just to go on the two last red flags I have for Arweave as a whole is, oddly enough, they were featured in the World Economic Forum's review of cryptocurrency use cases in 2020. You go all the way to page 12, and they gave them a pretty, sorry, not that, there we go, page 13 in my browser, I guess. They have a whole overview of Arweave, which is pretty, you know, standard. It is what it says on the tin. It's for storing, you know, files and keeping permanent storage, which is a pretty defensible protocol. I don't think that's a crazy idea. But then when you run into how it's connected to, maybe is it going to be used by the World Economic Forum? Who knows? And so I've really given you a crazy overview on what Arweave is so far. And we have some questions about Arweave AO moving forward, but what are your thoughts so far?
Look, so there's a few things to touch on here. So, the fact that Arweave in itself is mentioned in the documentation by the World Economic Forum, that's not necessarily a red flag. Where there is a red flag, if there is actually a partnership between the people behind that blockchain and the World Economic Forum or any other entity. So I'll give you two examples. Obviously, one very prominent example, and you mentioned them, is Ripple. So Ripple is actually a strategic partner of the World Economic Forum. I think that's a problem. Anyone that thinks that Ripple is the solution for anything, I don't know, that's a problem. Another DLT that I was kind of distributed ledger technology that I was quite bullish on and I thought had promise was IOTA, that doesn't use blockchain, that use something different. Now they are now officially partnered with the EU for a digital identity project, which is also problematic. So, you know, so it, just if Arweave is mentioned in a documentation by the World Economic Forum, that by itself is not a problem for me. What is a problem is obviously if there's a direct connection or funding or partnership. And the other thing is, and I don't know exactly how it works, but how their consensus mechanism, how do they actually run their consensus mechanism and can it be manipulated? That's one thing. That's on the Arweave side. On the Odyssey side, one a major kind of development that has happened literally, I think, over the last 2 weeks or so, is that they've, I think even actually over the last week, is that Odyssey announced that they're removing all ads. So there's no ads. Not in yes. the app, not which, on the website, which is great. Which that's fine.
Say, yeah. Yeah.
But that's cool. My assumption is, and again, it's impossible to verify, is ads. The ad revenue was basically the way they were sustaining themselves in the interim after kind of library was shut down, and now they're moving kind of to like a new monetization method, right? And even if that's not the case, okay, ads are gone. That's great. That's a welcome thing. But what is going to be the monetization going forward? Is it going to be through mining on Arweave? Is it going be like to be through charging people in Arweave tokens in order to upload content and then taking a cut on top? I don't know. And they're very kind of secretive about it. So they made a big song and dance about how they've removed all ads. And I asked, then how are you going to monetize yourself? The only thing they said is that, you know, they're confident in their own monetization avenues, confident enough to remove ads. Okay, well, what are they? So obviously you have something right. in mind, like let us know, you know? Sorry about that. So yeah. In general, I mean, I just find that since kind of like, you know, the old Odyssey is gone, their entire social media presence, be it the founder and be it the official like Odyssey account on Twitter, for example, they're kind of very secretive. They've become very clickbaity. So they're making very, very big statements, making very, very big promises, presenting themselves as like, you know, the next thing, the best thing since sliced bread. But when people who actually want details like myself ask them, okay, well, how? Like even when they announced like the future of Odyssey and they, I think they called it like decentralized media something. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the exact acronym. Okay, well, you said that you're going to announce. Yeah. So you said that you're going to do that and you're going to make an announcement and create a video and like, you know, put a post and put a video and they made a big, like, you know, marketing campaign around it. That's great. That's fine. No problem with that. But then when it was actually released, I read the post and I watched the video with some guy who's like clearly like an ambassador and not a tech guy. And I could say, okay, but how are you actually going to do that? I still don't have answers. And you ask, okay, well, how? Like what? Obviously you have something in mind. Okay. You've done the marketing. You build the hype. I have no problem with that. That's fine. But okay. Give us like the details. If you have them in mind, then let us know. Now, the fact that they're not giving any details, there can be only two options. One, they don't have those details themselves. They haven't figured it out. Right? Which is problematic. And the other one is even more problematic. They figured out the details, but most people are not going to like them. So they have some secret partnership. They have something going behind the scenes that most people who are freedom-minded, and that's the overwhelming majority of, like, you know, Odyssey's target market. Like, that's what people go on Odyssey. They're not going to like those details. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, have you seen anyone being able to extract any, like, details from the founders about how they're actually going to, like, you know, run the service, especially without ads?
Well, I agree with you that secrecy is a huge red flag. For instance, I consider myself pretty technical. You're pretty technical. And the fact that it's not obvious what they're doing to us in, you know, however long it's been since they announced that they're moving in this new direction, that's its own red flag. Because if it's decentralized, it shouldn't be secret. How do you really build a decentralized system in secret? Now, to defend them a tiny bit, it's not as secret as one would seem. I saw a tweet by the founder. I can't pronounce his name. I just butcher it anyways. But one of the founders who's still working with Odyssey, he was saying that they want to add monetization for creators based off fiat. So right off the bat, that's, I guess, probably the deal with the devil you have to make in this. It's probably going to be Stripe, would be my guess, because they run, like, basically everyone's monetization, you know, if it's fiat-based, and it's got to be for creators. I'm like, okay, it's probably Stripe, you know, just right there, you know.
I mean, they have that system in place now, and it is Stripe. So you can create memberships, and you can have, like, receive tips, and it is through Stripe. You connect a Stripe account.
But when I saw because I was trying to pour into what is this Arweave AO token that they're building on top of the Arweave system. And I believe this, based off everything I've dug into, I believe this is what Odyssey's plan is. I'm an outsider, guys. This isn't me spoiling the details. This is just speculation on my part. I believe they figured out at least what features out of Arweave AO they find interesting. And AO is going to be used to be basically the entire framework for the Odyssey, you know, new platform, which I would actually go as far as to say is actually a little a bit secretive, in the sense that they could have just told everyone they were using this new system that Arweave has been building for over a year now that actually isn't secret. They didn't tell anyone, hey, we're using Arweave AO, which is this big new project they've been building. And so it took me a little bit of while to figure out, okay, so what is this AO project? How's it going? You know, what's going on? And again, it's pretty open. You can learn how to build dApps, you know, decentralized applications for the Arweave AO system. And it seems to be a relatively functional decentralized computing platform, in the sense that one of its competitors, ICP, had a couple of forum posts where people were comparing and, you know, complaining about it, you know, these kind of things. But my biggest concern with Arweave AO is that it probably is actually a security. It's kind of, again, not legal expert here, but just as a, you know, drug big to the punchline here, the fact that they can't actually give it to Americans through their minting process really says a whole lot. And it's kind of deceptive, because they had this blog post about the, which I'll include in the notes, because I'll include a lot of the links in the notes here. They had a post talking about the, basically the tokenomics of the Arweave AO token, which they're like, oh, we're modeling it after Bitcoin. There'll only be 21 million and it'll be released on this schedule, yada, yada, yada. But then they also have this awkward pre-mine, which to me, like, I kind of break with you with the sense that I believe any pre-mine is bad just because of the incentives it creates, where suddenly how decentralized can it be really if the system is dominated from day one, which I think the problem is that when it comes to Web3 in general, I think nobody's going to be able to replicate what Bitcoin did, because that was the chance. And now everybody's like, oh, well, I want to cut myself a bigger piece of the pie. Though, you know, who knows where Satoshi's who knows who actually has control over Satoshi's coins? That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah. So just with pre-mining, I just wanted to throw it out. So just with pre-mining, my thought is pre-mining is problematic, as you alluded to, if the consensus mechanism is proof of stake.
Ooh, that's a good point. Well, that's kind of a good point, because so many of these tokens out there are proof of stake. And one of my personal rants about the technology in the Web3 space is you don't see any novel consensus mechanisms. You don't see a new coin coming out where it's like, okay, we figured out how to make a consensus mechanism based off something other than proof of work or proof of stake, or even a proof of work system that's more related. And one of the red flags that I think is really worth raising here is because I think there's something going on right now that I kind of call Web3 technocracy, where just because something is decentralized doesn't necessarily mean it's better, because we can actually end up worse off than we were with institutions we have that are imperfect but are in theory answerable to our structures. And there's this concept called DPIN, for decentralized infrastructure networks, and notably Arweave is included with many other file coins here, but this is an entire idea. And I'll switch to my other tab so it's a little more zoomed in here. And the entire purpose of this, fundamentally, is they want it so that you can tokenize everything. You know, if anyone's been listening to Allison McDowell, she warned everyone about this. This is not a new idea. This is something people predicted basically as soon as cryptocurrency came out. And the challenge I see is that the institutions we have are kind of falling at the seams. At the same time, you have these new systems being brought up to basically scoop up all the market share and scoop up, because many of these systems, especially when it's talking about energy networks, wireless networks, you know, these things can kind of be de facto monopolies anyways. And the thing I want to caution people the most about is, if you're using a Web3 system, whether it's decentralized X, Y, or Z, if you're not touching the token, you're not actually represented at all. You are a subject or a victim of the system, whatever it is. And I think the goal of these kinds of things is they want to try to solve automation problems that I'm actually quite skeptical they'll be able to solve. I don't actually believe you'll be able to build, I'm going to put the chart back up, but I don't think you'll actually be able to build this and do what they're seeking out to do. But that doesn't mean you're not going to be able to cause a whole bunch of problems trying to make that real. And that's kind of my biggest concern when it comes to these networks.
Yeah, you know what I say. I mean, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. I think Web3 is a complicated thing. So I'll give you an example. So to start with, you said like nobody has tried to come up with something that is different than proof of stake and proof of work. So IOTA, for example, doesn't even run on a blockchain. They run on a different structure called DAG. I think it's a directed cyclic graph or something like that. Right. So their consensus mechanism is quite unique. Right. And on the face of it, it looks good. Basically, like, you know, it works around edges. So basically any, block, I guess, for lack of a better term, that is added to the DAG, that is added to the graph, is verified by, the edges of the graph. Right. So that by itself sounds great, but two problems. First of all, IOTA is not decentralized. They have something called the coordinator that runs the whole network. So there's a node that runs the whole network. So it's not decentralized. I mean, they're trying to do what's called the co-decide, which is the removal of the coordinator, which has been promised for years now, but hasn't really happened. So obviously they have challenges around it, and they have like partnership with some. So they're centralized, and they have partnership with the European Union to create a digital ID. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think I've got a problem at this stage, right? So we have multiple issues here. We have issues, first of all, as you alluded to, if you don't actually have access to the coins or the tokens in the sense that you can take them off chain, put it in a self-custody wallet, and have full control over what happens to them, whether you want to participate in any mining, in any minting, in any, like, you know, security, like securing the network or anything like that. If you don't have that option, it's basically nothing. There's no difference between that and AWS, you know, I mean, or Google Cloud. Right. There's no difference. Then again, also, like, you know, how robust the consensus mechanism is, then whether it's truly decentralized. Now, if the consensus mechanism is robust, if it's truly decentralized, if you can self-custody the token, and truly decentralized is a big call, because I don't think any proof of work or proof of stake blockchain currently in existence is decentralized. And one can even argue that it is impossible to have them decentralized due to the nature of the consensus mechanism itself. Right. But assuming you can find a blockchain that is fully decentralized. Okay. It's completely separate from, like, you know, its founders in the sense that they cannot control it. You can self-custody the tokens, and the consensus mechanism is robust from a security perspective. That starts being interesting, right? So that by itself is not a problem, right? It can work, but I don't think we have something that works as well right now. I mean, even when I think about like, you know, private blockchain, various, like, you know, private Monero. Blockchain. Monero being prime example, okay? Monero is proof of work. So, yes, it is private, but can it maintain its decentralization? Okay, if Monero becomes a genuine threat, right, someone will, like, you know, make sure that, like, you know, they control 51% of the miners, and theoretically it can launch a 51% attack. So that's one thing. Now, I want to touch a little bit on the issue, like, you know, you keep coming back to the fact that, okay, well, it's a token, then becomes a security, then it's an SEC issue, and then the Americans can't participate. Now, my take on that, well, with all due respect, that's a problem that Americans need to sort out with their own government. If I'm starting a blockchain project, or if I'm trying to truly decentralize something, by definition, I don't care what one government or another, like, you know, thinks about it. I genuinely don't care. I should not care. Right? So, like, you know, I'll give you an example. Like, I mean, it's a good example with Americans. I mean, they have that thing with their tax. Like, I think it's only unique to Americans and one country in Africa where they have to pay tax on their worldwide income, even if they haven't lived in the US for 20 years.
Mm.
Right? But that is something that unique to Americans. And that's a problem that they have with their own government that they need to sort out. You know, same thing goes here. So, like, you know, if Americans can't participate in projects because, like, their SEC is, like, you know, making certain moves and defining certain things and security, and as a result, blocking, like, you know, their participation. Well, there's two issues here. First of all, Americans need to sort that out with their government. And second of all, okay, well, that's an issue with the project, because if the project can be blocked technically, not like through legalities, but actually be blocked, right?
Mm.
In a particular country, then how good really it is, and how, like, viable it is, and how really decentralized it is. Even with, like, you know, even with our library, I mean, why did they incorporate in the US? Makes no sense. Right? Same thing with something like Rumble.
That's a fair point.
You know, I mean, same thing. I mean, Rumble obviously is not decentralized and it has a myriad of other issues, but I mean, if Rumble was this, like, great, like, you know, free speech alternative, and they're so committed to free speech, and it's all about free speech. And really, I mean, when you think about it, that's their only USP compared to something like YouTube. Why did they incorporate in the US as a publicly listed company, right? Obviously, which puts them fairly and squarely out of their SEC jurisdiction. I don't know where all that. So they're obviously
and more able to be controlled, because once you're a publicly traded company, there's a whole bunch more regulations, a whole lot more pressures, a whole bunch more incentives. You're not just a small private company run by a couple of people anymore.
100%. And obviously, being a publicly listed company, like, you know, the Vanguards and the BlackRocks can buy you, and that will happen. That's inevitable. Right? So, I mean, that's very, very simple. Now, Rumble now, they've also launched, like, their public cloud service, right? So, like, to compete with AWS and Google Cloud, Microsoft Cloud, obviously, they're, like, you know, they're going to be, like, you know, protecting free speech. That's spiel, as usual with their service. That's great. But where are you sourcing your hardware from, your service from? Where are your data centers located? What are you actually doing? Like, okay, you make those claims. I don't know. Do you have the answer for that? I don't know. Where are the data centers actually located? I tried to look on their website, like the Rumble Cloud website, and all they have is a US East zone and a US West zone. Well, that tells me that it is in the US. I don't know. I think that's
right.
A problem.
Well, for me, I don't know where Rumble's sourcing its hardware from, but this is where, in my opinion, the broader scope of tech decentralization is a bigger problem than any cryptocurrency can fix. For instance, I don't know if you had the opportunity of seeing it. I recently interviewed Sam Smith, who's actually going through the effort of building his own operating system from scratch for a specific device. This is not a general purpose operating system you can just throw on a laptop. This is a very specific endeavor. And the thing is what I wish people, like, I'm not saying everybody needs to go ahead and do that. I'm saying I wish people understood what was involved in that process so that they would have a better understanding of basically where we are in this whole broader tech troubles issues, because you can't solve the problems that are inherent with the technological devices we have with just a new blockchain, with just a new company like Rumble or however much money you throw at it, because the devices are built in ways that have real consequences. Because the reason why Sam started working on its project is in some way an attempt to solve this thing called the 30 million line problem, which I'm going to basically summarize in the sense that our systems are built in ways that are very complicated, that maybe is more complicated than they need to be. And if Sam is correct that we can simplify devices, we can at the hardware level to make them more standardized, to make everything more open, to make everything more verifiable, the options are quite limitless. And so where I'm kind of trying to almost be charitable to, you know, Web3 advocates in the sense that the systems themselves aren't necessarily fruitless. There are probably real advantages you can get out of Web3 systems, but you're not going to get them if you keep building on a substrate of hardware and software that is really out of our control. And I'll say this because when you choose to build a program, you choose it with a particular programming language or a particular set of libraries. There are communities in those libraries and community and programming languages, and there are real impacts to your decision, not just technologically, but socially. For instance, there's this reporter out there, Lunduke, who's been covering a lot about how the free and open source communities have been very much just tightly controlled as corporations. If you want to get, you know, removed from a company for wrong thing, that can happen in open source too. There are lots of problems foundational to these ecosystems. And so I see a lot of this
WordPress being a primary example. I mean, yes, WordPress has been a primary example where they forced a certain direction, like, you know, with the blocks, like, you know, the block editor and all that sort of stuff. So that's an important point. I think what you said about hardware is actually very, very important, because if you boil it down to, like, let's just look at the PC market, right?
Yeah.
The PC market, all the chips, all of them, 100% come either from Intel or AMD. Both companies are strategic technology partners of the World Economic Forum. Now, what you build on top of that doesn't really matter if a company can decide, like, you know, to, like, you know, withhold its chips or introduce, or probably has introduced, like, you know, built in, like, you know, backdoors and vulnerabilities that it can exploit at any time, no matter what runs on top of it, because it is at a hardware level.
And to me, that's not a reason to say, oh, there's no point in doing anything. It's just more of a be pragmatic, be realistic, don't expect the world or utopia out of anything. But more importantly, preserve, you know, analog options. Why should we have to give up cash if we know our technology is not resilient enough for any of this? And everything they're trying to do, in my opinion, like on the government levels, you know, the EU is very focused on tech regulation right now, but across the world, they're introducing various speech and cybersecurity bills that, in my opinion, are really just a way of putting a fresh coat of paint over all these attempts to seize more power and control. And actually, I know we've kind of veered a little bit away from Web3 and cryptocurrency, but I want to revisit the concept of privacy, because another reason why I think Web3 can be used for technocracy in a pretty overt and terrible way is right now, if you have a data breach, somebody's responsible. For instance, there was this huge data breach down in the States that, and in other countries as well, affected something like a billion people. I forget how many people were impacted in this latest data breach, but it's massive, and it's because these companies are collecting information on people, and sometimes in not, you know, totally above board ways. And so there's this problem right now where if somebody is doing that, they're responsible and they can be held responsible. They can be sued. There can be class actions. There can be, heck, people could be get really mad and call their phone lines. Not that I'm recommending it. I'm just saying things can happen. Whereas if you use Web3 to diffuse responsibility, in the same way that people are using AI to diffuse responsibility, oh, suddenly it's not a company that's harvesting data on you. Suddenly you have chosen to use a blockchain that has no privacy. And that no privacy is a benefit, because just like, oh, it's 2030, I have no privacy and nothing's ever been better, which is that post by the World Economic Forum. Suddenly all your online interactions, you know, I could pull up that chart of decentralized physical infrastructure again. Suddenly, literally something as innocuous as you turning on the tap versus what videos you're watching and all those things. Many people assume, oh, that can already be harvested on you. Yes, if intelligence agencies want to spend thousands, millions, maybe tens of millions of dollars investigating a single person, they can pull up everything you've done digitally, one way or another, or if they put you under surveillance, they can physically monitor you, but that's expensive. Why not build a digital system that allows you to spy on everyone in real time in these various distributed ledgers? And the advantage of it is then anybody can use it. Then, you know, whether they, regardless of what kind of systems they want to build off of, suddenly you don't have to deal with all this legal issues of, oh, Microsoft has this information, Amazon has this different information, and oh, you know, your healthcare provider has different information. I believe the purpose of Web3 taking over everything is to create an explicitly zero privacy situation in a digital future. And that is something I think is worth fighting against. And not even, you know, it terrifies me that people are getting sucked in by the idea of, oh, it'll be decentralized, it'll be better. But I will say, if you're giving up privacy for decentralization, you're better off opting out. You're better off, you know, just doing everything with pen and paper at that level.
That one, I agree 1,000,000%. So this is where I kind of, and I mentioned it to you before we started recording. So I was a very big Web3 advocate when I kind of got into it in 2017. And over the last, like, you know, 6 to 12 months, I started to realize that there's something not quite right. And I'll give you an example. Like, you know, what you just said is perfect. So, like, you know, perfect example and a perfect, like, obvious example for something like that is Bitcoin, right? So Bitcoin is promoted as this decentralized money outside the control of central banks and all that sort of stuff. So first of all, one can argue whether that really is decentralized because of the consensus mechanism. There's a lot of data that suggests that, like, you know, there are a majority of the miners are now controlled by, like, you know, certain entities, right? But as far as privacy, I believe the word privacy is literally not even mentioned once in the Bitcoin white paper. People forget that. Right. It was never meant to be a private solution. It was meant to be a decentralized solution as an alternative to, like, you know, central banks. So let's say if everyone switches from the, like, you know, Swift fiat banking system we have now to Bitcoin, everyone. Right. So at the moment, what's going to happen? At the moment, if someone wants to track all your financial transactions, they have to go to multiple bank accounts in multiple countries, under multiple jurisdictions, running in multiple currencies, right? They can still do that. Correct. And they can still do that. And like, you know, law enforcement can do that. There's obviously partnerships, Interpol, all that sort of stuff, FATCA, all this sort of stuff. That's fine. But with Bitcoin, if everyone is on Bitcoin, right, putting aside, like, the idea of mixers and stuff like that, which can be blocked, right? But let's say, well, mixers go.
They're already putting developers of those kind of things in jail. Like, the Samurai Wallet dev was arrested, and this is a big fight now. Notably, like you said, maybe this is a problem Americans need to work out for themselves. But they're just because you're a developer, that itself doesn't make you safe. And that's kind of a problem, where if we want these decentralized solutions, we can't let people building them be put into jail.
Oh, 100%. And that's a whole different discussion. But I guess what I'm saying now with Bitcoin, and let's put the mixers aside for a second. If everyone is on Bitcoin, the whole world runs on Bitcoin, like, you know, the financial system collapses and everyone switches en masse to Bitcoin and everything runs on Bitcoin. It's not even law enforcement. Anyone, like, you know, can track, like, all the transactions that you've ever done. So, like, you know, the Genesis block, like, people know where, what wallet it came from. So they know that this is the wallet of this person or group of people known as Satoshi Nakamoto, right? So they know everything that, like, Satoshi Nakamoto, even though he's no longer on the scene, like, you can track everything that has happened since the Genesis block, where everything is gone, where all the transactions have happened. Anyone can do that. And instead of that being a significant effort, it's a minuscule effort. It's a non-effort. Right. You have software. There's, like, services that automate that. You can, like, literally pull out a person's entire transaction history. So I don't think that's a good trade-off at all.
And I will say there are a lot
because you haven't even achieved proper decentralization. So I think a lot of there's a lot of people now, like, you know, promoting Bitcoin as the solution. I think that's a problem because that's one of those things that they never discuss, right? I think there was a video. I think I've seen someone post that. Been a big, like, you know, it's very, very sleek, documentary called, God Save Bitcoin. I don't know if you've seen that. Been released, I think, I don't know, over the last couple of weeks. Maybe, but first of all, the name is problematic. Jesus. What now it's a religious cult. Like, you know, it's like kind of reminding me that video that Trump posted, God made Trump. Okay. So now it's a religious thing. And they, to their credit, one of the things that they say to themselves is, like, you know, it is not private. So that's something that we need to figure out. Now, with Monero has a very, very good privacy solution, right? And so is IOTA, by the way, because, like, your wallet address is single use, right? So it's like, once you use it, you can never use it again. So it's good, but IOTA is centralized. Monero runs on proof of work, which is a good consensus mechanism, better than most, but can still be taken over. So we kind of still have issues. So, like, unlike you, I don't think that blockchain does, and Web3 in general does not have a role to play in the future. I definitely do think that they can make a significant contribution, but people need to enter that with their eyes open and being educated. Yes. And knowing what are the inherent problems that exist in Web3, because they do exist. And if we don't think carefully how we're going to address that, then we're going to end up in the same situation. And the example that I just gave previously of everyone switching to Bitcoin instead of the current financial system is a prime example for that.
Right. And to me, one of the things that's a huge priority for me is I try not to be too opinionated on what I think people need to do. Like, in my writing, while I encourage people to do various things, to try it out or try to, you know, I try to explain various things, I don't want to say this is the solution, you have to take it, or the high road. I try to inform people that there are ways to understand these issues. Like, especially, I think this conversation is very important for that, because I don't think there has been enough eyes open when it comes to Web3 as a whole. But the thing is that, like you say, you can find applications for things that are benign, even if there are serious downsides to the technology. What I think is the ideal solution, regardless of where things end up, is I would wholeheartedly advocate for individuals, families, communities to build up their own digital infrastructure. Because, for instance, I was honestly facepalming a lot when I kept seeing clips coming from the Nashville Bitcoin conference that just happened, and people are kind of creaming themselves about how, like you said, how amazing Bitcoin is, how it's, you know, a religious cult now, and they wanted taxpayers to buy up everybody's bags. Like, that was, you know, horrific. And I saw this video of this guy on a, you know, one of the not the panels, but, like, basically people could walk up to his table and he would demonstrate stuff. And he explained that you could do Bitcoin over ham radio. Now, I understand how packet radios work. Like, I haven't played around with them, but I understand the concept that if you have ham radio communications, you can connect that through the internet. You can actually have internet over radio signals, and that's an achievable goal. But somebody asked him if, you know, Bitcoin could be done over radio. And the problem is, there's a huge difference between being hypothetically able to broadcast a transaction from, say, your wallet to a radio to somewhere else that actually has internet, and then they process the transaction. And that's the same as using an custodial solution on some level. You have to trust some of those people. They might never broadcast the transaction at all just because they received it. That's an entirely different ball game to, okay, the internet's down, how are you going to run Bitcoin nodes so you can keep your new, novel, amazing financial system running? And the discussion of this is not serious at all. You know, to me, there's a huge difference between something being theoretically possible, where he's like, oh, well, we have this thing that's Meshtastic, and Meshtastic is amazing. I like the project. I think it's a cool thing to play around with. But if you want to incorporate any technology into your solution for a grid down or an internet down scenario, practice with it, actually try it out, actually get it set up and do a few tests. and actually make sure you can get from start to finish of what you actually want. Because I see, especially in this technology space, especially when people start talking about decentralization and privacy, it's all about, oh, just do this thing and it might work out, but we're never going to try it. And then once you do actually try it, it's like, oh, there are these edge cases. Oh, suddenly it's not that easy. And you have to tackle those problems now before. Though truthfully, I'm a bit skeptical of like a super internet down scenario. I think the internet, even as it currently exists, benefits the system more than it benefits people. I said something when I first went on the Rounding the Earth show where I said, I don't believe we're using the internet well enough for them to shut it down. I don't think them stopping people from getting Musk's Twitter or getting various other central, Facebook, those kind of things, I don't think that would help them at all. So I'm not worried about the whole internet shutting down, but I do want people to take seriously, how are you storing your information? Are you storing it on your own machine, or are you putting it in the cloud or some blockchain with no privacy? Where your information is matters, because there's legal implications. If somebody has, say, a bunch of photos of you or is stalking and harassing you, what recourse do you have if it's a company or if it's a blockchain or if it's just some other guy stalking you? These are all serious considerations, and the details matter. And I'm really glad to be talking with you, Michael, about this, because I see you as somebody, especially in this space, who has the technological knowledge not to just buy into things the moment it's discussed, but you also do have, like you mentioned, you're not going to take something just based off associations that they're inherently bad. You want to actually think things through. And I'm just curious if you have any other thoughts related to everything we've kind of talked about so far.
Yeah, look, I think the internet down scenario is probably the most important conversation to be had in this space in general, because whether you are pro-blockchain or anti-blockchain or Web3 or not Web3,
True.
pro-decentralization, not centralization, if the it's kind of like the electricity grid, right? If the internet is down, okay, the internet, like the whole internet is down, then the whole all other discussions kind of become mute, right? So you said that you feel that we don't use the internet well enough for them to be interested in shutting it down. Maybe you're
And
right,
I'm hoping
but
we change that.
yeah, look, I mean, that's fine, but look at it from a perspective of two perspectives, and that's like a well-known thing. One is the financial system, and the other one is utilities, right? A lot of utilities, especially electricity generation, communication, are dependent on the internet, even though they shouldn't be, but they are. So if you turn off the internet, that will affect it, right? But the whole internet itself, when you say that they have no interest in shutting the internet down, I don't know. I would challenge that because one would argue you can say like they wouldn't want to turn off the or shut down the internet because that kind of destroys their own control grid. That's a valid argument, but we need to look at it from a different perspective as well. They want to shut down the internet, but they don't want to shut it down permanently. They want to shut it down temporarily to create a problem, that will result in a reaction, and then they'll provide your solution. So like to give you a very, very simple example, and that's not a theoretical, that's what the World Economic Forum and their cyberpolygon exercises has like written and practiced and demonstrated. So you have a massive cyber attack that that shuts down or that affects kind of like the internet, what is it called? The internet, not the mainframe, there's a term for that. Like the main kind of thoroughfare to which the internet runs, right? And that results in massive outage. Now, then the governments blame this, oh, this outage is as a result of I know, hackers, foreign state actors, whatever, blah, 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 inherent vulnerability in the internet. So that's fine, we'll fix that. But in order to prevent that from happening again, we need to kill off anonymity on the internet completely. You cannot
Fair.
log into the internet
Right.
without first having a digital ID and verifying who you are, and then we have to track everything you're doing. Sorry, no privacy because we don't know. You may be a malicious actor, and the only way that we can guarantee that this will not be happening again is basically do something like that.
And we've
Right?
seen that
So,
in the in the UK, they were explicitly talking about, oh, we need to redouble our efforts for digital ID over internet. Like, I agree with you that there are serious reasons to why they want to push for that kind of problem reaction scenario. And it doesn't need to be forever. Like you say, it can't just be for, you know, a couple of weeks until people comply. I actually did write about this. I did a piece, Tools of the Technocracy number 9, Internet Shutdowns. And the main thing I wanted to explain was that, you know, this is something that tyrannical regimes actually are already using. This is not a hypothetical scenario, but it's also true that it doesn't have to be an entire shutdown. It is still probably more efficient for them to shut down particular services. For instance, if you are able to interfere with a particular site or services, internet access, or filter particular content. And that to me was a big deal when the EU started pushing for, they wanted to have a root certificate installed in browsers so they could do what's called deep packet inspection, where basically they man in the middle all your connections so they can read everything you're doing online one way or another. And that's a big part of this problem, where there are many roads to the end goal of total control over people's lives and digital and online. And this is just one of those things. And so I agree with you that there are many important parts of this discussion that need to be taken seriously. And I kind of agree with you that it's under discussed. I wrote about this, and ironically, this piece did not get that much attention, you know, as I thought. I thought it was a really important topic. And it seems like part of the problem is that we've gone so far down into using technology and using these digital solutions that we're already so accustomed to them. But I hate to say it, it hasn't been that long ago that most things were done with paper files and people actually working in offices. Like, it's actually kind of astounding in the sense that in such a short period of time, we have become so dependent on a system that is so fragile, that is so easy for systems to control. Because actually, Cold Fusion just did a video on internet shutdowns I saw earlier today. And he said something that I kind of disagreed with, where he pointed out that, oh, this government does or does not have the capability of shutting down internet service, because apparently various laws have been passed in various countries about internet kill switch bills. But in my opinion, I believe things are in such a way that I don't think the governments need a law to make it happen. There are many
governments are not running the show. That's where kind of like the argument falls on its face. The governments are not running the show. The governments like receive their own orders, right? There are multiple layers above national government that are actually running the show. And I think really, I mean, you know, if you want to talk about like, you know, troubles in tech, I think in my personal opinion, and you know, we maybe disagree on that, but the most important conversation that we need to have when it comes to troubles in tech is not Web3 decentralization, like for the sake of decentralization, is the actual scenario of like, you know, shutting down the internet, and not by a government, but actually by a nefarious actor that can play on a global level to achieve a certain objective. So the discussion that needs to be had is, first of all, can that be done? In my opinion, and I'm also working on a piece about it right now, it absolutely can, especially with the current structure, like, you know, with basically most of the services being dominated by three cloud providers, right? So it absolutely can. Can a country block itself from the rest of the internet effectively? It absolutely can. The Great Firewall of China is a perfect demonstration for that, right? So we definitely have those issues. Now, the next conversation that needs to be had, okay, do we want to solve those issues, or do we want to just give up on the internet and go back to like, you know, pen and paper? And that's also like, you know, some people would argue that that's what we need to do. Like, for example, people argue that like, you know, the concerns around, you know, 5G and 4G radiation, or even like, you know, using things like Wi-Fi, we need to go back to like, you know, wired solutions or eliminate mobile services. And again, that's a worthwhile discussion to be had. People can agree or disagree. That's fine. So we can look at a higher level. Okay. Do we need to like, you know, stop relying on in the internet and run things with pen and paper on the side? If we decide, okay, well, predominantly like because of our current, like, you know, structure, our current economic structure, our current societal structure, we need to rely on the internet. Then we need to think, okay, well, how do we prevent a situation where the whole internet can be shut down by a nefarious actor, or a government can completely isolate its citizens from the rest of the internet, right? So we need to go back to, I guess, like the original vision of the internet, which was a military application. I mean, DARPANET, the whole idea with DARPANET was basically to maintain a communication network that will continue operating after a nuclear strike. I mean, that is pretty intense, right? Now that I would argue, hey, that's a pretty good thing for us to have, provided it is not controlled by a government. That's bloody good. Oh. So what happened as the internet, as DARPANET transformed into the internet, obviously all the civilian applications came on board, a lot more users came on board. So obviously it became a lot less resilient. So do we want to go back maybe to that idea of actually, okay, well, we agreed that the internet is important. We probably won't be able to continue operating as a society in the way we currently do without the internet. Okay, that's cool. So maybe we need to change the way the internet operates. And that's really ultimately everything stems down from that, because everything, the internet is like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's the ingredient that you make. It's the asphalt. You make like the road with asphalt. If you have no access to asphalt, you can't make roads. So, and everything else runs on those roads. Like, you know, if you have no asphalt, you have no roads. If you have no roads, you have no cars, right? So in the sense, the internet is not the road. It's even the asphalt. At that level, like, so maybe we need to change the ingredient with which we build the internet. And I don't have the solution for that, but I think that's the discussion that needs to be had. Maybe we need to make the internet a lot more resilient, like, you know, like what it was like, you know, during the days of DARPANET. And then, okay, if we decide to do that, how are we going to do that while allowing the same amount of users to use the internet and to access the internet and have all these applications that are running on the internet? And maybe we'll come to the realization, hey, look, we can't do that. Or we can continue with having the same amount of people on the internet, but we can't maintain all the applications that are currently running on the internet. These are the discussions that need to be had now. Right?
Well, to me, the thing that I find most helpful about trying to address that particular problem is there have been many community internet initiatives. There was some country in South America, I wish I remember which it was, where basically everybody's connected through a community internet and they're all connected to each other. I believe New York has various community internet initiatives, and it's a worldwide thing. Like, there's many of them across the world. And in my opinion, the priority people should think about is if we want to actually make censorship impossible, if we want to make shutting down the internet impossible, be that resilient, you need to think about how are you, you know, digitally connected to your neighbors. Do you want everybody along a block to run a wire through each of each other's homes and, you know, connected by routers? However you want to do that, there are many options available. It's just we need, in my opinion, the solutions lie in we figuring out what we actually want. Like you said, we have to have those discussions, but then we need to actually start rebuilding tech with those solutions in mind, rather than simply trying to jerry-rig various tech solutions that will probably never be user-friendly enough that people can rely on. If we recognize the problems, if we decide there's a new direction we want to take things, and we spend the time investing in the education, knowledge, and training to build the devices that we actually need to support that system, suddenly the problem becomes an achievable goal rather than this pie-in-the-sky idea that people will sell subscriptions, you know, to really milk day in, day out.
Yeah, look, so I mean, that's really the important discussion. And I mean, obviously, before we had Web3, we had the Fediverse. The Fediverse is a concept that is a lot older than Web3. But the Fediverse really never took off because it wasn't user-friendly enough, or maybe it was a marketing issue, or maybe it was just too fragmented. I don't know, but I mean, maybe that's a concept that needs to be revisited. I don't have the answers, but I think we need to make sure that we're asking ourselves the right questions. And while like Web3, yes or no is an important question, there are questions that are even more important in the current situation, because Web3 runs on the internet as it currently stands, which is effectively centralized, right? So how do we solve that first before we even have a discussion of same thing with Fediverse. I mean, the Fediverse, it also runs on the internet as it currently stands, which is centralized. So, you know, so what do we do?
Right. I'm a big fan of the Fediverse, and I'm glad you brought it up. Oddly enough, Because I think the big killer innovation that the Fediverse, in my opinion, popularized among the people paying attention to it is that you can have services that talk to other services. For instance, that's how telephone lines work. You know, your phone carrier has to negotiate deals with other telephone carriers, and all it is one service talking to another so that the users of the entire ecosystem can benefit. That's why it's possible for you to dial a couple of numbers and reach someone in an entirely different country. So the thing is that I think, you know, if we really want to go far down a never web 3 direction, you know, one interesting idea here is that, is it possible that Bitcoin focused on the wrong part of the problem? Because what Bitcoin tried to do was it tried to solve counterfeiting and trust in an environment where you can't trust anybody, but most people do trust somebody. For instance, banks exist. Regardless of how we feel about banks, banks was trying to solve the problem of banks and didn't solve other issues. But if you were to build, and this is a hypothetical idea here, but if you built a payment provider for a bank and then you use the Fediverse concept of banks talk to other banks, because they already do that. That's already how that works. And so suddenly online payments were just connections between banks. In Canada, we have something dangerously similar. It's called e-transfers. But again, it's more top-down because Canada's financial system is more top-down. Let's be real here. But to me, the idea that, you know, especially Americans have to go through things like PayPal, have to go through these things, we're either letting the governments and companies build them, or we're not allowing the banks to actually innovate in this particular direction. You know, for instance, I find, especially as a Canadian, it's quite staggering that my bank won't let me have a long password or won't let me use, you know, new security methods. Like, it's actually quite sad that, you know, many of these, you know, bedrock institutions have basically been falling down on the ground and not actually, you know, taking the modern advancements as they exist. I understand change is slow, but at the same time, with all the change that has been forced on people, it's kind of suspicious that a lot of really good changes that are hypothetically possible have basically not materialized or being prevented from happening.
So where to from here? Like, what do you reckon? Like, you know, I think we've discussed a lot of things. And I think we may, like, you know, want to start thinking about, like, you know, what takeaway people who are not even, like, you know, that techie as you and I and don't really, like, not really interested in, like, you know, the technological details of protocols and stuff like that. What do we do? What is, like, the main problem that we have right now? I would argue that the main problem we have right now is the fact that the internet, which basically our entire society relies on, can be shut down, can be controlled. A country can shut down its citizens from the internet, right? And basically, like, you know, it's also obviously becoming, as a result, becoming in that sense, becoming fragmented, where people in certain countries can't access certain services and blah, blah, blah. So
I'm sorry, I think that that's terrifies a problem. That terrifies me in the sense that if there are severe human rights abuses or tragedies that go on across the world, if they can cut off people's access to information, suddenly horrible regimes, militias, you know, whatever the scenario is, they can get away with terrifying results and probably deal with it before anyone has the time to respond. And the challenge of today, in my opinion, is that it is not just governments and governments anymore. You have governments dealing with particular parts of the population they don't like. You have various, you know, inter-country factions. Like, it's a very complicated game. And I agree with you that not only should we be seriously concerned about an internet down scenario and how we prevent, you know, worldwide messages from being disseminated, because I agree with you, that is such a critical thing, especially right now with a lot of the abuses going on. But then on top of it, I would say as an individual person, you may not know what you can do about that, but I would say at minimum, be careful who you're empowering. If you're somebody who's on X and you're saying, thank the Lord, you know, Elon Musk has saved free speech, you're basically marketing his plan to take over digital infrastructure. And I hate to say it, yes, if you do some Web3 direction, you are kind of just enriching the holders of that proof of stake coin, if that's the arrangement you're in. And so you should be very careful about what solutions you're using and who they actually empower would be my word of advice in this regard. Thank you so much for joining me, Michael. Is there any one last thing you want to say before you head off, we close this up?
Yeah, look, I mean, that's basically what you said. I mean, the perfect, like, you know, this is actually the perfect way to end it, because what you just said boils down to what is fundamental to everything that is happening in our world, and basically fundamental to all the solutions that we can figure out whether independently or like, you know, with other people. And that's, you have to think for yourself. Ultimately, people have to think for themselves. Like, you can propose a solution. I can propose a solution. It may sound good to some people. It may not sound good to other people. And that's perfectly fine. But ultimately, people need to think for themselves. That's one thing. Second thing, people need to stop obsessing about personalities and what they're saying. Because a certain personality was right about something, or they said something on one aspect that you like, for example, like, you know, Elon Musk saying there's only two genders, doesn't necessarily mean that he's automatically now your friend and everything he says is in your favor and everything that he does is in your favor. Like, people ultimately have to think for themselves. That's basically the message for everything, whether it'll be tech, whether it'll be like, you know, religion, whether it'll be like, you know, financial system, whether it'll be like, you know, government, everything. Ultimately, the evolution that we are in right now and the way out from our current predicament is everyone start thinking for themselves. That's probably the best way I can end it.
Thanks a ton, Michael. And I hope you, anyone who's listening right now, really enjoyed this conversation. Again, I'll have a lot of the information in the notes for this discussion here on whatever posts, or I'll be also putting it on PeerTube because I'm a big fan of decentralization, as although I have reservations about how it's done. But also, I will be including ways to reach Michael. He has his own Substack, actionabletruth.substack.com. And thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Please let us know what you think.